Yes, good morning.
Yes, I can as well.
All right, good morning, everyone. This is our second case on the calendar this morning, November 30, 2022, 822-0453, Warner versus State of Minnesota. Counsel, you'll each have 15 minutes for your primary argument. The appellant has an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. These matters are being recorded. I ask that you state your name and your client's name before you begin speaking. Let us know how you'd like us to reference you, if anything. And these matters are being recorded, as I stated. That is the only recording that is permitted today. Clock is up on the corner. Let us know if you're having trouble seeing it. Otherwise, we are ready to proceed. Counsel, you may proceed at any time.
Thank you. Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is John Donovan. I'm an assistant state public defender, and I represent the appellant in this case, Corey Warner. During a search of Mr. Warner's SUV, law enforcement discovered two THC cartridges in the center console and an unloaded, uncased shotgun in the back seat. I raised issues about both of these items in my brief. I would like to begin my argument today with the second issue regarding the shotgun. Minnesota law provides that a person may not transport a firearm in a motor vehicle unless that firearm is unloaded and in a gun case expressly made to contain a firearm, and the case fully encloses that firearm. The statute as written does not contain a mens rea element. Because the language of the statute, the nature of the offense, and the legislative history do not show that the legislature intended to impose strict liability, this court should construe the statute to have a mens rea element that Warner knowingly transported an uncased firearm. Because the evidence was insufficient to prove that he knew he had a firearm in his SUV, we ask this court to reverse that conviction. Criminal offenses typically require both a volitional act and a mens rea element. Mens rea is the element that requires a defendant to know the facts that make their conduct illegal. Mens rea is the rule of criminal law rather than the exception to it, and strict liability offenses are generally disfavored.
Counsel, can I just ask a couple of jurisdictional questions before we get into the meat of the argument?
Sure, Your Honor.
This is a misdemeanor offense, correct?
Correct.
Okay. And the judgment was entered when? September 14, 2021, right?
Let me just pull up my procedural history. I believe that, I think judgment was not entered. The conviction was not entered on the felony until January 4th, 2022.
I'm not asking about the felony. I'm asking about the misdemeanor.
I don't know that there's been a misdemeanor conviction actually entered at this point.
I think on the warrant of commitment.
I will be honest with Your Honor, I wasn't anticipating this, so I don't have that pulled up right in front of me at the moment.
Well, here's where I'm going with it, okay?
Sure.
So it looks to me that the warrant of commitment provides for the entry of the conviction on September 14, 2021, mm-hmm. and the appeal was filed April 4, 2022, and the rules of criminal procedure provide that an appeal from a misdemeanor has to be within 30 days. So I'm wondering if we have jurisdiction to consider this argument.
I believe you do. And I'm trying to, again, I apologize. I'm trying to catch up with you here because I believe that the rule on appeals, and I know we're talking about the misdemeanor, but I believe the rule for felonies is that when you are appealing that felony, you can then challenge anything else related in that same warrant of commit, I believe is the rule. And I want to be sure I'm correct on that. But I think that because we were appealing from the felony, you can also raise the issues with the misdemeanor in this.
Even if jurisdiction has expired? I'm just wondering how that escapes a jurisdictional bar.
So in rule 28.02, subdivision 4.3a, time for taking an appeal, and it says, in felony and gross misdemeanor cases, an appeal by the defendant must be filed within 90 days after final judgment or entry of the order being appealed, other charges that were joined for prosecution with the felony or gross misdemeanor may be included in that appeal. So because this misdemeanor was joined in that prosecution for the felony, I believe this court would still have jurisdiction to consider the misdemeanor. Does that, you were muted. Does that answer your question, Judge?
It may.
Okay.
You should proceed. Go ahead. Thank you, counsel.
If the court would like further briefing on this, if you want more afterwards, of course, we're happy to do it.
I'll consider that. Thank you very much. Go ahead, counsel.
As I was saying, this misdemeanor statute is silent on the issue of mens rea. When a statute is silent, sort of unlike the state's position, that's not the end of the analysis. That's the beginning of the analysis. What that calls on the court to do is to then examine the language of the statute, its history, and the nature of the offense to determine if the legislature intended to impose strict liability. What you're looking for is a positive indication that the legislature intended that. Looking at the statutory language, there are typically four ways in which the legislature shows that it intended for a statute to have strict liability. The first way is just an explicit statement that it's to be strict liability, which is not present in this case. The second thing the courts look at are other subdivisions in that same statute. Do other subparts of that statute contain a mens rea element? In this case, no, there is no other subpart that contains a mens rea. Courts also examine other statutes on similar subjects to see if they contain a mens rea element, which would show that they intentionally omitted it in the challenge statute. Again, that's not the case here. The similar statutes, transporting an archery bow does not have a mens rea element. Possession of a firearm without a permit does not have a mens rea element. So there's nothing in the language there that would indicate a positive indication that the legislature intended strict liability here. Finally,
Mr. Donovan, so this statute has been amended several times by the legislature, but it has never added a mens rea requirement. Doesn't that seem to indicate that it does not require one? Because you're kind of going down the path of legislative history, which I'm not sure we really need to go down. But the fact that they've never amended it to add that, even after cases applying it, doesn't that seem to indicate that they have no intention? We should just look at the plain language of the statute?
No, Your Honor. I think it's actually the reverse of that. I think that if there was evidence at some point, either in the legislative history when the statute was enacted, there was discussion of mens rea, or if at some point the statute had a mens rea element that the legislature then deleted in an amendment, I think that would show a positive affirmation or a positive intention that they intended for this to be strictly liable. Now, no court has, as far as I know, ever construed the statute to consider this issue. So I think the fact that this has remained a statute without mens rea actually cuts in favor of Mr. Warner's argument. The statute has never shown any sort of intention in that, in those changes, that they intend for this. They clearly intend for this to carry strict liability. So,
but why don't we just look at the plain language? And it sounds like you're trying to read in something that isn't there, especially for a misdemeanor where generally there's no requirement for mens rea in misdemeanor cases.
I'm going to take the misdemeanor part second, if I could, and just sort of start with reading into the statute. That's what courts do. Courts routinely read in language into the statute as far as mens rea goes. Courts have very openly said, look, there's no mens rea. We're going to add one in here. There was no mens rea in CRM. There was no mens rea in Schwartz. There was no mens rea in Dickum. And even though that was the plain language, that was not the end of the analysis. That's what begins the entire analysis. So when the statute is silent, that's what calls upon the court to look at everything else. I know generally when courts are interpreting statutes, they say, we're not going to add language. Mens rea is, I think, clearly in the case law, the exception to that. Courts openly read in mens rea. I mean, and just sort of beyond the cases I've cited, we need look no further than the other offense that Mr. Warner was charged with. There's not a mens rea element in fifth degree possession of a controlled substance. Courts have read in actually two mens rea elements. You have to knowingly possess the item and you have to know what the item is. Again, that's a statute that's silent, but courts routinely will read it in. As far as for this being a misdemeanor, that is sort of a further factor. I think that's the least weighty factor. The Supreme Court, our Supreme Court, and the United States Supreme Court have routinely refused to draw a bright line rule. Just because something can be a felony, they're not going to say that it can't be strict liability. That's the case in Schwartz. I'm not aware of a case that says that because something is a misdemeanor, it means that there isn't any mens rea. How the United States Supreme Court has looked at this is they've said that, you know, the main focus, because now we're sort of in the public welfare type of statute, is the nature of the item itself. The misdemeanor part of it is that generally public welfare statutes are, a misdemeanor sentence is more congruent with that than a felony sentence. But they've never said that just because it's a misdemeanor means that there isn't any mens rea. The focus of that analysis is still, is this an item that's so inherently dangerous? Is this a statute that communicates a clear intent for strict regulation? And I think the answer to that is no. Both, again, the United States and Minnesota Supreme Courts, both in Dickham and then in the Staples decision, have said that firearms are not so inherently dangerous that they're strictly regulated and subject to the regulation that puts the owners on notice. I understand those are possession cases, and we're talking about transporting a firearm. But I think the statute itself, like in Dickham, shows that it's not so inherently dangerous that it's categorically prohibited. Like in Dickham, there were many exceptions when you could carry a pistol without a permit in public. That this statute here is very similar. There are many exceptions for when you can carry an uncased, unloaded firearm in your vehicle without it being a crime. If you are traveling to or from a hunting area, if you are going on a shooting range, if you're on public hunting land, the fact that there are so many exceptions, I mean, and frankly, just in the first part, you can have a loaded firearm in your vehicle as long as you have a permit for it. And what we can take away from those exceptions is that this is not an activity that's so strictly regulated that it should impose strict liability.
But, you know, you're only looking at it in the general context. This statute originated and has been interpreted a lot more in the hunting context. Mm-hmm. And when you're hunting, you cannot have an unloaded, uncased gun in the passenger area of your car. It has to be in the trunk. That's just basic law.
But I would disagree.
It applies in all. Pardon?
I would disagree. I think that there is a named exception that the loaded part I'm not going to disagree on, but you can have an unloaded, uncased shotgun, that's subdivision 3 of the statute, when you are traveling to or from a site that you intend to lawfully hunt that day or have hunted that day, or if you are lawfully hunting on private or public land. In both cases, you can have an unloaded, uncased shotgun in your car. So I don't know that it's as categorically prohibited as you might have suggested there. I don't know of really many cases that have interpreted that statute, and I certainly don't know any that have interpreted the mens rea element here. But I think given that there are so many times when you can travel with, it shows that it's not a statute that's strictly regulating the transport of an uncased firearm.
Mr. Donovan, I'm not sure we can necessarily, I tend to agree with Judge Kirk. I think you're conflating two different types of whether it's inherently dangerous or not. One is possession, say, for example, you know, possession in your home where you have a very, very strong right to protect yourself versus a situation like this where you're actually transporting. And the language of it is, I mean, it even says restrictions. And it talks about a person may not transport if it's unloaded, unloaded in a gun case. Case fully encloses the firearm by being zipped, snapped, buckled, tied, or otherwise fastened, and without any portion of the firearm exposed. It's pretty explicit in terms of you can't have how restricted that has to be when you are transporting. Now, as you know, yes, there are two exceptions. One, if it's unloaded in a closed trunk, but even there, it has to be in a closed trunk. It can't be open. It can't be, you know, and you know, then you've got the other exception with the handguns. But the language there is pretty restrictive.
I have sort of two responses. First of all, I think there are several more exceptions than just a closed trunk or the handgun, because subdivision 2 is a subdivision about exceptions. Subdivision 3 is a subdivision about exceptions, which provide numerous times when you can. And I think this is very similar to the Dickham case when they were saying, you know what, possessing a handgun without a permit, there is no mens rea there. But look at all the times when you can possess one in public. And they have very similar exceptions in that statute. That statute is 624.714. If you are taking the handgun from your house to your place of business, you can do it. If you're taking your handgun to have it repaired, you can take it with you in public. If you are out in the woods, you can take it. If you're, you know, transporting it in a motor vehicle, I guess that one sort of has the same language. But there are those similar exceptions in the Dickham case, and yet still the Supreme Court said this is not so inherently dangerous that it's strictly regulated and that that it's going to impose strict liability. They still imputed a mens rea element there because of those exceptions. I think the exceptions here are very similar, which would also show that that the statute should not have a mens rea or a strict liability rather. I see my time is about to expire. So unless the panel has other questions right now, we would ask that you reverse this conviction outright. And as far as issue one, that you grant Mr. Warner a new trial. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Anything else from the panel? Counsel, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Appreciate it. Counsel, anytime you're ready, as soon as the clock, there you go.
Thank you. May it please the court and counsel, my name is Carlotta Navarette. I'm Assistant Lyon County Attorney. I represent the respondent. The two issues before the court, as stated previously, is whether the district court committed plain error when it convicted appellant of felony fifth-degree controlled substance and whether the appellant's conviction for transporting a firearm should be upheld. Regarding the first issue, the district court did not commit plain error when it convicted the appellant of the fifth-degree possession. Under the plain error doctrine, an appellant must show that there was an error, that it was plain, and that the error affected his substantial rights. In regards to jury instructions affect an appellant's substantial rights if that error was prejudicial and affected the outcome of the case. It is respondent's position that the jury instruction was not a substantial error because of the evidence that was presented at trial. It is correct that the penalty statute subdivision 4A1 for a felony conviction for controlled substance does require that the state prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the appellant possessed 0.25 grams or more of a controlled substance. In this case, all the evidence regarding the controlled substance included the nature of the substance being being THC oil, and it included that the weight of the substance of one of the cartridges that he contained was at 0.545 grams of the THC oil. So in hearing that, the jury would have reasonably concluded that he did meet that particular element, even though it was not presented to them on the jury instructions. All of the testimony from Ms. Olson, the BCA scientist, Exhibit 13, which is her report, contained that information, and no evidence was presented that it was erroneous in some way. So the respondent does believe that based on that, the appellant's substantial rights were not affected because all of that information was presented. It's reasonable to conclude that the jury believed the scientist and found her credible as to the nature of the substance and would have found it credible as well as to the weight of the substance. Regarding appellant's conviction for transporting a firearm, the respondent respectfully requests that that be affirmed. There is no mens rea on the statute. And as Judge Reyes pointed out, that reading one into it is not necessary if there is just the plain reading of the statute according to statutory interpretation in Loge. If the meaning of a statute is clear and free from all ambiguity, the letter of the law should not be disregarded under the pretext of pursuing the spirit. And that is what the appellant is asking, that this is a very clearly written statute of what is required to transport a firearm, and whether the appellant did that or not determines whether he was in violation of the law. I understand that, as Mr. Donovan stated, that a lot of that strict liability statutes are often disfavored. However, according to Moser, public welfare crimes and crimes where the circumstances make it reasonable to charge the defendant with the knowledge of the facts that make it the conduct illegal, this is one of those cases that falls into that, given the nature of what is being transported. It's very similar to, say, a speeding case. A person can be convicted of speeding even if they don't know what the speed limit is in that particular area, because they have chosen to drive the vehicle. They are charged with knowing what the law is. It is similar with firearms. That statute has been modified several times, amended several times, and yet the legislature does not put in a mens rea required that you absolutely have to know that you can only transport a firearm in the backseat of the car so long as it's unloaded and in a special case. And in this case, the evidence was sufficient to convict the appellant of this offense. The testimony indicated the appellant was the driver and sole occupant of that vehicle. He was the registered owner of the vehicle. There was no testimony that anybody else was using that vehicle. Exhibit 14 shows the shotgun outside of its case being removed from the vehicle. And the appellant also discussed how he thought it should be transported, that he thought it was okay to have an unloaded firearm in the back seat. As Deputy Damoth testified, indicating that he knew the firearm was in his vehicle. He knew what he had, and therefore he, under the statute, would also need to transport it according to the requirements of the statute. So the respondent respectfully requests the court affirm his conviction. Unless the court has any questions, I do have nothing further. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Anything else from the panel? All right. Thank you very much. Mr. Donovan, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it.
Thank you. Just one moment, please. Thank you. I'll be very brief in rebuttal. I did want to circle back and touch on issue one briefly. I think it sort of seems as if the state is conceding that there was plain error to not instruct the jury on the element that elevated this offense to a felony. I still think that that affected Mr. Warner's substantial rights for a couple of reasons. I think the state's argument comes down to, well, the evidence was sufficient to show the weight. And I have a couple issues with that. First is the fact that this isn't a sufficiency review. This is plain error review. So the evidence isn't the only thing you're looking at. You're looking at other things there as well. I think importantly here, does the jury's verdict encompass that erroneous, in this case, missing element? The answer would be no. The other thing is that because this isn't a sufficiency review and it's plain error, the court isn't looking for is there sufficient evidence. The court is looking for is there overwhelming evidence. That's what the standard is on plain error and jury instructions. I don't want to play cagey defense attorney and say, was Ms. Olson's testimony sufficient? Probably, but I don't know that it was overwhelming. So I don't think that there's overwhelming evidence here. And I think maybe sort of more fundamentally in this case, is that oftentimes when you're looking at plain error for jury instructions, one of the instructions isn't quite right. This is a case where the jury wasn't instructed on an entire element. So in order for this court to say that there was sufficient evidence, this court is essentially going to have to play fact finder. And as we all know, this is not a fact-finding court. This is an error-correcting court. But because the jury was not asked to find this element, this court would have to find that element on its own in order to say that there's sufficient evidence here and it wasn't plain error affecting Mr. Warner's substantial rights. And sort of by that same token, in addition to having to act as a fact finder, the court, to a degree, would also have to act as the prosecutor and determine what the theory is. There are three ways that something can be a felony fifth degree offense. You either have a prior violation of Chapter 152, the weight is 0.25 grams or more, or there's more than one dosage unit. Now, there's no mention on whether or not he had a prior conviction, so I don't think that was the theory. No one's really talking about dosage units in this case. I don't know if dosage units apply to cartridges. These are not like pills. These two cartridges are, you know, as the evidence or the exhibit show, these have different amounts of THC in them, so it's not like two ibuprofen pills are the same. These are different things. And as far as the weight goes, I don't know that that was actually the state's theory either, because in her rebuttal closing to the jury, the prosecutor said on page 141, top of page 142, you don't have to find a threshold weight. You don't have to determine how much it weighs. So I don't actually know what the state's theory was for how this was going to be a felony. Probably weight, but she makes an argument saying you don't have to find a weight. So were they taking some other avenue?
But I think that's a little bit different though, counsel, in terms of, I think that still is acknowledging that there is a weight that meets the requirement. And if that's the one that, I understand your argument that of overwhelming, but that seems to be pretty strong evidence there when you've got the weight that meets the statutory requirement that's over that requirement. And that's just for one cartridge. The other one wasn't even weighed at all.
True, Your Honor. But again, that's the court finding that fact. That is not the court saying that the evidence was sufficient to support the jury's finding. That's saying the evidence is sufficient to support our finding, our being recorded.
Well, no, just be clear. That's not us saying that we're making that finding. That's us looking at the record to see if there's sufficient evidence in the record to support the jury's verdict.
But again, the jury didn't make a finding, so the jury's verdict doesn't have a weight factor. And as far as the argument, her argument was, is it 0.25 grams, is it 0.5 grams, is it one whole gram? It's any amount that is contained. So she's not necessarily saying, you know, it meets a threshold regardless. She said any amount, so they weren't asking it to find it. But again, just fundamentally, he has a due process right to have the jury find this element. And the jury did not find that element. So because of that, we think it affected his substantial rights. Because of that, I think it affects the fairness and integrity and reputation of the judicial proceedings if he can have a felony conviction without a finding by the jury that this was a felony offense. So unless the panel has any other questions, we would again ask for a new trial on issue one and outright reversal for issue two.
Thank you, counsel. Anything else from the panel this morning? All right. Thank you very much, counsel, for your briefs and your argument this morning. We will take the matter under advisement and issue an opinion within the statutory time period.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.